Baxter International versus Abbott Lab.
May it please the court, Constantine Trella on behalf of the appellant, Baxter International. Baxter is here today challenging an arbitration award. Baxter's challenging the award because the award is contrary to public policy. It's well settled that the federal courts will not enforce arbitration awards that violate the law or are otherwise contrary to public policy. This is just a particular application of the general rule that courts will not enforce illegal contracts. An arbitration award is, in effect, a contract between the parties. As this court has recognized, arbitrators as agents of the parties can do anything the parties themselves could do. But the converse is also true.
That, of course, leads straight to my principal question. After Baxter acquired the second Cebu Fluorane process, could Baxter have simply decided not to market it?
I believe that Baxter could have decided not to market
it
unilaterally.
Unilaterally. And the arbitrator made that decision for Baxter.
So
what's the problem?
The arbitrator made that decision for both parties. The problem is that Baxter and Abbott could not agree that Baxter would choose not to market. Baxter made its intention quite clear. Baxter wants to market Cebu Fluorane. Because Baxter and Abbott together could not agree.
I don't know why. Baxter and Abbott are, as the arbitrator said, essentially the same person with respect to Abbott's sale of Baxter's patented Cebu Fluorane.
I don't think the arbitrator said that Baxter and Abbott are essentially the same person.
No, but I just did.
Oh.
How are they?
Abbott is selling Baxter's patented process. Any student of industrial organization would view this as a form of vertical integration by contract. But so far as this process is concerned, Baxter and Abbott are the same thing. And now Baxter has decided, through the arbitrator, not to market a second Cebu Fluorane product. And you've just agreed that that doesn't have any antitrust problems. Well,
I've
left.
I didn't agree to that. I agreed that Baxter unilaterally could have decided just they can decide not to market any product.
Hmm.
It could have decided not to market the non-infringing Cebu Fluorane.
Which is why one would think that if there was an antitrust problem here, it was Baxter's acquisition. Because Baxter, as Baxter now depicts things, engaged in a merger to monopoly in the Cebu Fluorane market. And that might well violate Clayton Section 7. Indeed, on your view, Baxter certainly violated Clayton Section 7. But it's hard to see a violation of the Sherman Act.
I do see where you're going, Your Honor. It is not Baxter's acquisition of Omeda that created the problem here.
Why? There were two potential sellers of Cebu Fluorane. There was competition, and Baxter then acquired both, eliminated the competition.
Well, Baxter eliminated competition only in the sense that the arbitrators decided in 2001 on behalf of both parties that there could not be competition. If you look from the perspective of 2001, obviously at that point, Baxter had acquired Omeda 3 years earlier. By doing that, it didn't change the competitive landscape.
Certainly it did. I mean, I would be shocked if the antitrust division would have said something like, acquiring the only competing producer of Cebu Fluorane doesn't change the competitive landscape.
It changes the competitive landscape, Your Honor, only if you assume that the 1992 agreement contained a covenant not to compete. But the arbitrators expressly held that the agreement
I won't pursue this, but the antitrust problem is that Baxter, after the acquisition, owns all the competing processes for selling Cebu Fluorane. It is a monopolist. The fact that it happens to have licensed Abbott to sell on its behalf doesn't make it less a monopolist. And your complaint about the arbitrator's award is that it recognized that Baxter is a monopolist.
No, I don't think that...
Why this should enable Baxter to get relief under the antitrust laws is something of a puzzle.
Baxter had completely divested itself of the one process. It was an exclusive license. It was for the life of the patents. So that Baxter was not the owner of that process anymore. It acquired Omeda in 1998, 6 years after the Cebu Fluorane agreements were signed. And at that point, it could have been a new competitor had the arbitrators permitted it to proceed with its plans.
Aren't you asking us, in effect, to reverse the decision of the arbitrator because it violates your sense of public policy.
No, we are asking the court to reverse or to decline to enforce, at least, the decision of the arbitrators because it violates the express public policy in Section 1 of the Sherman Act.
You agreed to be bound by the arbitrator that you agreed to.
We agreed to be bound to the resolution that the arbitrators reached of disputes arising under the agreement.
Does this prevent anybody from marketing a generic equivalent of this drug?
It prevents the only party that is in a position to market a generic equivalent from doing that. And that's for two reasons, Your Honor. One is, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, there are two commercially viable processes. We have one, Abbott has the other.
And they have the other.
The other reason is that Baxter is the only producer that has FDA approval to sell generic sevoflurane. And there is no evidence at all that there is any other producer in a position to compete in this market, certainly not before this these agreements and the award expire in December 2005. So it does, in fact, preclude competition, and there is, as a
what
factor...
What difference does it make whether somebody else might compete in this market?
Well, I don't think it makes any difference. The arbitrators and Judge Guzman seemed to think it made a difference in the sense that they said... Baxter failed to prove that generic competition is not still possible, which I think is where Judge Coffey's question certainly seemed to be going. We don't agree that that was Baxter's burden to prove that that no other generic competitor might somehow be lurking out there. But even if it were somehow Baxter's burden, as a factual matter, there's just no evidence that there is anybody else out there in a position to compete. Now, the consent decree, let me just touch also on the consent decree, because that, Judge Coffey, is another aspect of the public policy argument here. There is no dispute that the FTC consent decree to which Abbott is subject is an expression of public policy.
No. It's just a contract. Abbott said it would do the following things, as usual, without conceding liability. Right, there's a contract between the FTC and Abbott. How is that public policy?
Well, Your Honor, the first thing I would note is that Abbott has not challenged the proposition that that consent decree does reflect public policy and reflects public policy in the sense contemplated by the New York Convention. So whether that would have been a good argument for Abbott to make, they didn't make it. And also, Your Honor...
And what's your response?
Well, my response... My response is that it certainly is a contract between the FTC and Abbott, but it's more than just a contract between private parties. The FTC is acting as the United States in its role as the antitrust enforcer. This consent decree in particular is part of a broader FTC effort in the prescription drug area where these agreements between brand name manufacturers and generic competitors have been a particular focus of FTC concern. And in the W.R. Grace case, the court noted that obedience to judicial orders is the kind of public policy that courts should take into account, and I don't think there's any material difference between an agency order and a judicial order in that sense. The consent decree on its face applies to these facts. It requires Abbott to cease being a party to agreements in which it is the name brand manufacturer and it agrees with a generic producer not to market a generic alternative. That is, in effect, what the arbitrator's award, the kind of an agreement the arbitrator's award has created.
Have you asked the FTC to take any steps?
There is nothing in this record concerning...
Have you asked the FTC to take any steps?
This matter has been brought to the attention of the FTC.
Which has done what?
Which, I have to go outside the record, obviously,
no.
Your Honor.
Whether the FTC has done something is a matter of public record. They file their complaints in public. This is not...
The FTC
not asking
has,
you any secret details. They've either done something or they haven't.
The FTC has not done anything publicly yet, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Now, turning to Section 1 of the Sherman Act, this is a horizontal restraint on competition. It is horizontal because the restraint goes beyond the scope of the licensing agreement itself. The licensing agreement concerned just a particular process. This covenant not to compete that the arbitrators created goes beyond that and applies to the product as a whole. It's a naked restraint because it's not even arguably necessary or helpful to a productive venture. Obviously, viewed from the perspective of 2001, when the arbitrators actually imposed the covenant not to compete, it could not facilitate any cooperative venture at that point. At that point, it was like the restraint in Blackburn versus Sweeney. The cooperative arrangement had already been made, and the restraint came afterwards. But even from the perspective of 1992, even if you were to assume, contrary to the arbitrator's findings, that those agreements contained a covenant not to compete, this restraint on competition was not ancillary. And it's clear from cases like General Leaseways and Marshfield Clinic that merely because parties enter into a cooperative venture does not mean that any restraint on competition to which they might agree is necessarily ancillary. What we know here is that the agreements were silent concerning competition. It's difficult to believe that sophisticated parties would leave out a term that was in some sense important to their arrangement. There's absolutely no contemporaneous evidence that competition by Baxter was a concern at all.
Whatever scope we may have in reviewing a claim that the agreement is construed violates the arbitration laws, we have no authority to review the arbitrator's construction of the agreement. That's what you're asking us to do now.
I don't believe that's what we're asking, Your Honor. The arbitrator's construction of the agreement was that the sevoflurane agreements are silent concerning competition. As a result, they, in effect, filled that gap under the broad authority they were given in 2001. But even if you believe that there was a covenant not to compete in 1992, it could not have been ancillary to any productive venture. There's no record support for the notion that this competition by Baxter was a particular concern.
Counsel, do you realize you're into your rebuttal time?
I do realize that, Your Honor.
You can continue if you would like.
I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Right.
Please, the court. Mark McCarrans on behalf of Appalee Abbott Laboratories. Your Honors, this is a pretty straightforward case. We're asking you to affirm Judge Guzman's confirmation of the arbitral award. It's in essence a contract case. They raised this public policy argument.
Has anybody protested to the Department of Justice? I asked your adversary about the FTC proceedings. And presumably the Department of Justice could bring a proceeding as well. Anything going on there?
I'm aware of nothing on that end.
This is a process patent. Of course, Mr. Trella made this point in his presentation, but it seems to me to be a very significant one. This is a process patent. And there's no indication of conferring any particular rights over the product, the distribution of the product, yet we come out of this arbitration award with a monopoly situation as to the distribution of the product, and competition has been excluded. How can you justify that?
Number one, Your Honor, competition has been excluded because Baxter acquired Omeda. But for
Baxter, that's their perfect right to acquire Omega. What difference does it make whether they own Omega or Omega provides the competition on their own behalf?
A second point. Omeda, designed around this patent from publicly available information, or so the arbitral panel found.
That's not illegal, is it?
Pardon me?
That's not illegal, is it?
Not illegal. I wouldn't suggest it was, and it suggests that there's really no barriers to entry to anybody else coming in and competing. I vigorously oppose Mr. Trella's statement that there is no record evidence of other competition. There is record evidence.
It's irrelevant, isn't it? If you're going to suppress competition by the only known competitor, what difference does it make whether other people might compete?
Well, it begs the question as to the competitor of what? Are there other anesthetics out there that compete? The answer is most assuredly yes, outside of sevoflurane. I think to suggest that sevoflurane in and of itself is the market would be error. There's no record support for that. And there's
apparently it has characteristics that make it preferable to other products, other anesthetic products.
Well, again, to answer that question, we need to go back to the record for the arbitral panel, and I would respectfully suggest that if Your Honors do that, there is no record evidence to support that proposition that sevoflurane in and of itself is a marker, and that there is plenty of competition in other forms of anesthetics, both inhalant and injectable. And that's, in fact, what the records show. So to suggest that competition here has been foreclosed and some terrible tragedy has been inflicted on the consuming public as a result of this award is simply not supported by the record. The public.
Well, we have an agreement not to distribute a generic product against a patented product. It's not an unreasonable assumption that there will be additional competition from the generic product, is it?
I would respectfully suggest, however, that in the event the court would find a problem with this particular arrangement, which I think Judge Easterbrook called more akin to vertical integration, that any non-compete between anybody would violate the law. This court has been one of the leading courts in the United States on the development of the doctrine of ancillarity. This is an ancillary restriction that is coterminous with the life of this licensing agreement. Plain and simple.
2005?
Yes, sir. The last patent expires in 2005.
All right. Proceed with your argument.
Thank you.
Again, this so-called ancillary agreement has nothing to do with the process patent that was the subject of the agreement.
Well, I think it does, Your Honor.
This is a different process we're talking about.
Well, I think it does. Again, with all due respect to Mr. Trello, the record evidence is complete that Abbott would not have entered into this arrangement if it had thought that Baxter could compete with it. Why, would you ask yourself, would a company like Abbott commit to commercialize a product that had not been commercialized before outside of Japan and spend $1.4 billion to do so if it didn't think it might have some protection over the life of the licensing agreement?
Protection as to the product. It's got protection as to the process.
We have protection against on the process, and we had protection, as the arbitrators found, under two different theories against Baxter competing with us on sevoflurane. If they compete with Abbott Laboratories on other anesthetics, and there's no prohibition on that. They continue to compete. They may compete, and those are the same anesthetics that compete with sevoflurane.
Go ahead. So that you can get it out.
Thank you. Public policy. Mr. Trello says it's well settled. I don't know how well settled it is. I looked at the cases cited by the appellant. There are very few cases, if any, that acknowledge this public policy argument and then go the draconian step that they advance here, and that is to vacate this arbitration award. Public policy in the antitrust area, Your Honors, what they're really asking for is a third bite at the apple. They had one bite in front of the arbitrators on this very issue. Public policy, they chanted. That was their mantra. You cannot fine in favor of Abbott. It would violate public policy for the very reasons before Your Honors today and the same very cases. They raised the same issues in front of Judge Guzman. He declined to accept them. Public policy. This is an ancillary non-compete embedded in a very complex and toughly negotiated four-way partnership agreement. There was testimony from the parties that this was akin to a partnership. And now one of the partners wants to compete midstream with another partner. And why do they want to compete? Because they acquired Omeda. I would respectfully suggest that they not be entitled to a third bite at the same apple. On the FTC front, Mr. Trello suggests that there's been some sort of waiver under the convention. I would respectfully disagree. Our fundamental position from day one is that they have no standing to raise this point. That's not been waived. We've raised it repeatedly, and the lower court and the arbitrators gave some credence to it. in the event that any court decided to allow a third party.
How does this agreement fare under the joint FTC Department of Justice joint venture guidelines?
Fares in the sense of whether it would be.
Suppose this were submitted to the department or the FTC, depending on which has jurisdiction under the joint venture guidelines. How would the guidelines call for this to be analyzed?
Rule of reason.
They're a little more complex than that. They try to make the rule of reason, which is an empty phrase, operational for joint ventures. Now, maybe you're just not prepared to discuss that. It's not in your brief.
I am.
Well, then how would it be analyzed?
It would be analyzed, the pro-competitive effects of this. Now, we're talking about back in 1992, correct? That the guidelines were in effect and submitted back in 1992.
I would be interested in either 1992 or now.
What happened here, Judge Easterbrook, is that as a result of this joint venture in which three parties, contributed hundreds of millions of dollars, is that a new product, Sevoflurane, under the brand name Ultane, was introduced to the United States and the rest of the world outside of four other countries. There was a huge pro-competitive justification for this joint venture arrangement in the first instance. And I would respectfully suggest under the guidelines that if there was some sort of business review letter submitted with the appropriate attachments, that either the Department of Justice or the FTC would have approved this transaction. Again, on the FTC point, Judge Guzman, I think, was correct. Even assuming arguendo...
Why didn't the agreement have an express covenant not to compete with respect to the product, if this was such an important part of the arrangement originally?
The record evidence, Your Honor, was that the parties, and this is a quote, never dreamed that Baxter would ever even contemplate. Now, good lawyering, hindsight's 20/20.
Well, the dream isn't in the record either.
That's a fair observation. But the parties expected at the time that Baxter would exit the business. They had no intention, Your Honor, of marketing this product. They didn't have the financial wherewithal or the commitment, and they actively solicited and approved Abbott to be there, in Judge Easterbrook's terms, a joint venture. The FTC issue, I think, is a non-issue. I don't think they have standing. I think if this court were to seriously consider the point, numerous third parties, a la Baxter, would have standing to raise that issue before Your Honors and the other district courts.
I keep asking what other people are doing. You just prompted me to ask one more. Have any consumer lawsuits been filed concerning this transaction?
Not to my knowledge.
I assume a consumer lawsuit would come to your knowledge.
Well, with my client sitting there, I wish I was the exclusive lawyer for Abbott, but
that would violate the antitrust laws.
I would have at least stated in the advance sheet, Your Honor, but I have not.
Thank you.
The public policy argument here with the subsets of the Sherman Act and the FTC consent decree is really a red herring for vacating an agreed-upon arbitral process. If we're talking about public policy, shouldn't we really weigh the public policy interests that are at issue here? They've stated their public policy argument. What about the public policy of favoring arbitrations? What about the public policy of enforcing contracts, whether, Your Honor, this was an express or an implied condition? The legal effect is the same.
Well, it wasn't implied. How was it implied if it wasn't expressed?
Well, the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing was found by the arbitral panel as being one separately sustainable contract theory to keep them out, and the second was an express argument under the original commercial relationship language. So the parties had anticipated.
Well, that commercial relationship business, seemed to me the basis of the arbitration was that in sustaining the original relationship was that there should be no reduction in anybody's revenue. That was about the bottom line, I thought.
Well, certainly, but...
Which is not a bad business basis for making a deal, but it didn't strike me as being a very, very whether there's any very clear commercial relationship.
Well, the expectation, though, on the record evidence, Your Honor, back in 1992 was that this product had not been commercialized. No one was stepping forward to commercialize it, and in fact, it took 3 years of clinical development and trials before the FDA even approved the product for use in the United States. 3 years. This was not a slam dunk. This was a very risky proposition, and that was the party's expectation, that there was a risk.
That just brings back my question. Why didn't they expressly agree on a covenant not to compete if that was necessary to put the deal through? And your answer is, well, they didn't ever anticipate that the present circumstances should come up. But
well, I think
I'm not sure I understand why they couldn't have anticipated some possibility of that sort.
And again, I apologize because apparently my earlier answer was unsatisfactory, but at least I'll be consistent and say that I believe, and I think the arbitrators found, that under the original commercial relationship language, which one may debate the pro or con, but that's not an issue, as Judge Easterbrook indicated here in appeal today. That's not an issue on appeal. That was an express provision of that four-way agreement between all the parties, that there would be no impairment of the original commercial relationship, and the finding was that Baxter's decision, purported decision, to purchase Omeda and come back and compete with its own exclusive sublicensee would violate that express provision. The
if you need an extra minute to continue your argument, go ahead.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I don't believe I do. I think the public policy interest here, if there's any public policy interest to be weighed, weighs in favor of Abbott. It weighs in favor of the entity that spent this sort of money, made this sort of commitment, and accepted this sort of risk and gamble, as the president of our client testified. It was a risk and gamble. At this stage of the clinical development of this drug, the odds of successfully commercializing this product was 1 out of 100. And they rolled the dice on 1 out of 100 and spent $1.4 billion. And through the efforts of Abbott Laboratories, this product was commercialized for the benefit
of... Have they made $114 billion on this drug?
Have they made... No, they have not. They did not see a positive...
If they thought the chance was 1 in 100...
Yes.
And they spent $1.4 billion, then the return would have to be $114 billion to make it a profitable venture. So they couldn't possibly have believed that the chance is 1 in 100. Sounds like traditional business exaggeration, but it's not something to be given credence.
Well, it may be
exaggerated. Did Arthur Anderson tell him to use that figure?
Can I take the fifth on that question? I will say, Judge Easterbrook, that the contemporaneous records, the intent of the parties at the time of entering the disagreement reflected those odds. Whether those odds are something of a mathematical certainty, I don't comment on. But that was the mindset of my client in 1992 when they entered into this agreement. With all due respect, I would hope that this panel would confirm Judge Guzman's decision to confirm the arbitral award. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Very briefly, Your Honor. First, as a factual matter, this was not a 100-to-1 shot. This product had already been introduced in Japan by Maruishi, one of the other parties to this arrangement, and had been highly successful, and Abbott was well aware of that success because it was competing with another Abbott anesthetic in Japan. So the odds were nowhere near as long as Mr. McCarron suggests. Mr. McCarron expressed some doubt about whether this public policy doctrine actually exists. There's no doubt in this case because it is expressly part of the New York Convention, which governs this case. The New York Convention has, as one of its provisions, that the courts shall not enforce awards that are contrary to the public policy of the country in which they sit. Now, Mr. McCarron said that Abbott would not have entered into this this arrangement if there hadn't been an understanding that Baxter would not compete, and he said it never dawned on anybody that Baxter would compete. Well, that's not right. It, in fact, dawned on Maruishi, which was Baxter's actual direct counterparty, the party with which Baxter was negotiating. Maruishi expressly considered whether it should try to obtain a covenant not to compete from Baxter, but it decided, well, we have an exclusive license as to this process. We've got a lot of other tough issues to negotiate. Essentially, they decided we're not going to expend capital trying to get this covenant. We think we've got enough protection. So it did, in fact, dawn on the parties, and they decided this was not a concern. So it clearly was not ancillary, whether looked at from the perspective of 1992 or 2001. Now, Mr. McCarran's also said that it's a mistake, that we're maintaining that sevoflurane is somehow the market here. That's not our position. The point here is that this is an agreement to restrain output, which will have an impact on prices. There can't be any dispute here that keeping Baxter off the market will have an impact on prices. In fact, in the agreements themselves, they provide that the price to Abbott will be reduced as soon as a generic competitor appears on the market. Throughout the parties' negotiations was the recognition that generic competition will lead to a reduction in prices, and that's in fact exactly what happened with respect to isoflurane, one of the other inhalable anesthetics. Finally, on the consent decree, the issue is not standing. We are not asking this court to enforce the consent decree. The issue is the consent decree is a reflection of public policy, which this court has the authority to enforce under the New York Convention, and which Baxter has the standing to invoke under the New York Convention. If the court has no questions, I will sit down. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We will proceed to Key.